And here we go. Welcome to Deep to Deep. I'm Pastor Dennis Dickinson. I pastor Whitestone Christian Fellowship in Payette, Idaho. And I'm looking forward to our time today. Last week we introduced the New Testament books. This week we're going to introduce the Old Testament books. Try and get these in an outline form so you can kind of get a feel for where you are in the Old Testament. Did you know if you read one chapter a day, you'll read through the Bible, at least the New Testament, in a year? It'll take a little longer for the Old Testament, but nevertheless, it's worth doing. We eat the scriptures, it's called our milk, we drink them, they're our water, they're our life, they're the breath of the Messiah. They're all kinds of things. Now, let me give you a couple of dates to hang your hats on, okay? One is 2000 BC, the other one is 1000 BC. 2000 BC, you're at Abraham. 1000 BC, you're at David. David and Solomon and that era. It'll help you just a little bit. Now also, if I were to give you the basic outline of the biblical text, what I'm going to give you is just this. Now watch what I'm going to do here. Genesis, Exodus, up through chapter 19, Numbers 10 to 36, this is where they set up away from Sinai. Chapter 19 is where they arrived at Sinai. Then you have Joshua, Judges, 1 and 2 Samuel, 1 and 2 Kings, and then they go into the exile. And then you have Ezra and Nehemiah when they come out. Now, if you know those basic books, you've got the Old Testament story down. Everything else inserts inside of them. Okay, so when God creates Adam in the beginning and Eve, places them in the Garden of Eden, literally the protected area of pleasures, all that means. And by the time sin enters into the world and you get down to through the flood and arrive at Abraham's day, what you do is you insert Job right around that time, because some of the names in Job fit identically with Abraham. So does also Job's priesthood, and Job said he was a king. It's like he's part of that order, of that Melchizedek order, etc. Now, promises are made to the seed of the woman. It would crush the serpent's head. And you go on down to the time of Abraham. You have the seed of Abraham who's coming to bless the nations. And Galatians actually cites that and says it's Jesus. Isaac, it's repeated. And again, it's Jesus. And then you have Jacob and the 12 boys. And Jacob, the promise is repeated to him. And you know the story, how they end up down in Egypt. And Joseph is down there. And Joseph is a picture or a type of the coming Messiah also. Now, take Job, put it in there with Abraham, you leave the book of Exodus, and you end up at the time of the captivity in Egypt. Now, when you get to Exodus, obviously Moses shows up. He's a type or picture of the Redeemer, and he is the one who's going to lead them out of slavery and bondage, the slavery of sin, and he will take them to the promised land, but he can't take them in because, you know, law comes by the lawgiver, and the law won't get you in, that sort of stuff. But he brings them out. You've got the 10 plagues, a tithe of all the plagues that God is going to bring upon them. And at the end of chapter 19, it drops them right at the foot of Mount Sinai. And so they sit there for the next 2 years. Exodus 20, God begins to give them the Ten Commandments by which he'll judge mankind. You shall not, etc. And then he gives them the pattern for the ark and the priesthood. And I say the ark, actually the tabernacle, the ark of the covenant, the menorah, the table of bread, the table of showbread. All those things are given to them right there. Now, they will sit there until the book of Numbers, and in Numbers, it opens up with them numbering the people. Now, remember, the people are they've got to be numbered by the priests, and the issue is clean and unclean. David got in trouble when he numbered the people for war, but David wasn't a priest, and he usurped the priesthood by doing so, and he did pretty much what Saul did when he offered sacrifices. Anyway, at Numbers 10, they set out. You have their wilderness wandering. Now, you know they didn't do very well in the wilderness wandering, but did you know that 1 Corinthians 10 applies the wilderness wandering directly to Christians now? Absolutely right now. No temptation is taken you, but such is common to man, and it plays off of that and talks about the rock that followed them in the wilderness was Christ. If we behave like they did, God will do what he did, because God doesn't change. We know how God behaves. Okay, now they wander around in the wilderness, and God tests them for a time, and they tested him right back. Okay, now, at the end of that time, you're upon the banks of the Jordan. Moses is there, and he gives his last teaching to them, and that is the book of Deuteronomy. And in Deuteronomy, he tells them, God, you know, God's going to raise up a guy for you. And he tells them a little bit more about the Messiah, who's coming and how it's going to look like, how to recognize true prophets and false prophets. He says, if God is going to speak to you, he will speak from among your Jewish brothers. You must be Jewish if you're going to write scripture. And then he says, it has to come to pass, whatever he says. It has to line up with God and what he's already shown them, etc. Now, at that point in time, Moses passes from the scene, and God tells Joshua, I will begin to exalt you in the eyes of the people, and I'm going to be with you just like I was with Moses. And so he does so. Joshua, of course, is the Hebrew word for Jesus. And the law, Moses cannot take you into the promised land, but Joshua or Jesus can. As a matter of fact, entering into the promised land, Hebrews 4 and 5, is entering into Jesus, entering into his rest, entering into the Sabbath days, entering into Jesus, etc. Now, in Joshua, you're going to have a seven-year invasion. And Joshua, or Jesus, was going to lead them in victory. They go to the city of Jericho. Now, you guys know this story, but let me show you something. Jericho is Ir Ruach, the city of the Spirit. And that's why they're going to take it out first. It's the spirit or the ideology that ties these guys all together. Did you know, your spirit, you think with your spirit. Ezekiel says, I know every thought that enters into your spirit, but we translate it mind. Your spiritual life is your thought life. Be transformed by the renewing of your mind. Now, Joshua's going to take them in. They take out the city of the spirit. They deal with the philosophies, ideology, that tie them together. And later on in the book, it is called the Lords of Jericho, are those lords, the Canaanite lords. They are the Lords of Jericho. And it is that spirit that ties those guys all together. Now, fascinating story. This ends at the foot of Mount Hermon. Now, you know that Mount Sinai is called the Mountain of God and the Mountain of Yahweh. But Mount Hermon is also called the Mountain of God. It's Israel's water supply. So when it talks about the refreshment in the Psalms, it comes from Mount Hermon. Well, that's what he's talking about, the water supply. And it says that the giants came down from on high and they fought down at the foot of the Mountain of God, just like in the book of Revelation. So you have a warm-up of what things look like while you're there. Now, Joshua 24:15, choose this day who you will serve, as for me and my house, we're going to serve the Lord. Okay, and that's how the book closes out. Now, in the book of Judges, this is fascinating, because during the book of Judges, you know the story that everybody was doing that which was right in their own eyes, etc., except for this Moabite gal named Ruth, because she belongs in the book of the Judges. Now, in the book of Judges, you have seven judgments of God. And you guys know surely by now that the number seven carries the idea of completion and wholeness and that sort of thing. But God raises up deliverers, and he calls them a couple of things. One, he calls them shepherds, but you'll like this. In Hebrew, he keeps saying he raised up a Yeshua, he raised up a Savior, he raised up a Jesus, he raised up another Jesus, and he raised up another Jesus. So the judges come along in the role of Jesus, the Spirit working with them and overshadowing them, etc., Jesus being the spirit of prophecy. You find the judges where that was going on. And by the way, in the wilderness wandering, it says that everybody was doing that, which was right in their own eyes also. Right in your own eyes is right in your own opinion. It's the way you think. Oftentimes, to a Jewish man, you think with your eyes. It's the way you see things. Now, in the midst of this, while everybody's doing that, which is right in their own eyes, there's this Moabite gal, Ruth. Her name means beloved or attractive. And Naomi, you know, her and her husband leave the land because of a famine. They come back, and you have the story of the Goel, the kinsman redeemer, and how she marries in. It's the line of the Messiah. And in fact, if you will look at the name of Naomi, by the way, I find this fascinating. I was going through Daniel one time, and I found Israel is called the Naomi land. So she's kind of a picture of Israel and the land of Israel. When she goes back, she has no land. She has no inheritance. It's a great picture of Israel. Okay, now, also, she's married to a man. Look up his name. She's married to a man who's got a role play here. Ruth comes in, and when Naomi's two boys die, you have what's called the kinsman redeemer. That is, it's called Levirate marriage. Not Levite marriage, but Levirate marriage. And in that, if a man dies and leaves no male offspring, he leaves no kids, What happens is his brother or an uncle, somebody extremely close to him and only immediately close to him, comes in, takes that gal, goes into her, and the child that's born has the name of the dead man. So it's not named after her or the man whose child it is, and it's a picture of the resurrection of the dead. So that's what happens, making Ruth's son, not Ruth's son, but in fact Naomi's boy, making Naomi's boy also the son of God. And all you need to do is look up his name. Okay, so that goes on, and it gives you a genealogy at the end, which ends with David. Because in Genesis, when a child born of fornication cannot enter into the assembly of the Lord for 10 generations. So it takes that back up to the time of Judah, and it runs it down to David's generation, and you can count them, and you actually have 10 of them. Okay. Now, Judges begins to close out, but be careful here, because when Judges closes out, remember in 1 Samuel, Eli is the priest, but Samuel himself is the last of the judges. So you have an overlap. Now, Eli and his boys, you know, that they were corrupt beyond belief. They were violent. They were immoral, lying, cheating, thieving, etc. And Eli, their father, was the high priest and should have dealt with them, but he didn't. Instead, when they would steal the food from those trying to give their lives to God, he would just go over there and join them for the barbecue. Anyway, so you have Samuel as a boy dedicated, his mother dedicated his life. He was raised at the temple, well, the tabernacle, I should say, at this time. By the way, the word temple and tabernacle are used interchangeably in the Hebrew text. But he, as a boy, is raised, and he becomes the voice of God. He becomes a picture of Jesus himself, and he's going to replace them, but he's the last of the judges. That's important. When Samuel is growing up, Gideon is out doing his mighty deeds. I've always pictured Samuel going down to the corner drug shop and grabbing the latest magazine on, upon Gideon, and see what Gideon is doing, and see what Samson is doing, and see what all these guys are doing. But anyway, Samuel is a boy growing up when Samson is doing his mighty deeds. And now Samuel becomes the kingmaker. He is going to appoint Israel's kings. Now, before I go any further, don't miss this. In Deuteronomy, it says Moses was king in the wilderness. He is Israel's first king, Israel's first prophet, and Israel's first priest. And he says, God will raise up someone like unto me, and that would be the Lord Jesus, who was the prophet, priest, and king. Now, Samuel, it says, they haven't rejected you, they've rejected me, God told him that. And so, they said, they asked for a king, and they gave him a man named Saul. Now, don't miss the play of words here. Saul, in Hebrew, means asked. It's like, they got him because they asked for him. You ask for it, and that's what they got. And he was not a good man. And they wanted him to go out and fight battles. They just want this physical monster of a guy who could go out and be tough as nails and, you know, jump in the ring and beat everybody up and do all that kind of stuff so they could be like the nations. They didn't want to be like God or his unique people. They want to be like the nations. That failed miserably. And that brings us down to about 1000 BC and 2 Samuel. In 2 Samuel, there's a man after God's own heart. Now remember, we know from Ruth that we were waiting for that 10th generation to come, and that was in fact King David. And the Psalms are being written. David, the great psalmist, and most of the Psalms are written by him, one by Moses, one by Solomon, and some for the sons of Korah and the sons of Asaph, etc. But anyway, as those Psalms are being written, each and every Psalm, and I mean each and every one of them, points to the coming Messiah. Everyone is for him. Now, also, during the time of David, some people would tell you that Chronicles fits in as a repeat of Kings, but it really doesn't. Chronicles goes back to Adam, runs up through a genealogy, gets you to the King David, goes through David and Solomon, and then runs to the end of where Kings is and the exile. So, Chronicles is literally about the rule of David and his promised son. It's a book about David, who is the Messiah, and the promised son. Now, this, don't miss this. When we see the word Messiah, or say that, it is the word anointed one. And so, David wouldn't touch Saul because he is God's anointed. That is, he is God's Messiah. David was anointed. He is the Messiah. And then Solomon, his boy, was anointed as the Messiah. God said there wouldn't be a greater than Solomon, and Jesus said, well, a greater than Solomon is here, and there's your picture, that he is the true son of, of David. Now, you have David's mighty deeds, and David and the story, he collapses in his life later on when with Bathsheba and kills Uriah the Hittite, and etc. We'll come back to Bathsheba and Uriah the Hittite here in just a moment for some other insights here. Now, as David passes from the scene, he does these pictures of the Messiah. God makes promises to him that he is going to have a throne, and that throne, by the way, Israel's throne is called the throne of God, and that David's son would be called the Son of God. God said he'll be my son, and he will rule forever. Well, Solomon died, and it was a picture of Jesus, as we've already pointed out. As he passes, Solomon comes to the throne. He's a picture of Jesus and his rule. And as he rules, he opens up ruling with a rod of iron. It is absolutely amazing. He's going to build the temple. By the way, here's a little fun. He calls Hiram to help him build the temple, but he says to Hiram in the Hebrew text, I am going to build the temple because there is no Satan. Literally, there is no adversary is how we translate that. But during the reign of Jesus Christ in the book of Revelation, there will be no Satan. He's locked away. Now, as King comes in and he begins to build the temple, when he's young, he writes the Song of Solomon. This is like Song of Songs is in verse 1, what he calls it. Now, when you have a Song of Songs, that's in Hebrew like saying King of Kings, Lord of Lords, Holy of Holies. Song of Songs is the most holy song. And it's about the romance between a man and a woman. Israel used to say it's Yahweh and Israel, and later on the church said, no, it's God, Jesus and the church, but it's really neither. There are things that are inappropriate to put in God's mouth in that book. But the spirit that is the flame of Yahweh is the very passion of marriage, and we're dependent upon him for that in our marriage. Now, when he's midlife, he writes the book of Proverbs. Now, remember who's writing these? The son of David, who is considered the son of God, a picture of Jesus Christ himself. So in Proverbs, it's the son of David. He's writing about how to live life, and it's the Spirit of God working through him as a prophet, writing on everything from borrowing and lending and boys and girls and friends and parents and having your own kids and all that other stuff. And that's midlife dealing with in Proverbs. Of course, even in Proverbs, you've got pictures of the Messiah. The king's heart is in the hand of God, and he turns it whatever way he will. Well, not every king, just one king. And that king is Jesus. Also towards Proverbs 30, who is the name of the Holy One, and what is the name of his son? And until then, you don't know anything. So Proverbs is just full of those kind of things. And it actually ends, by the way, the story of the virtuous woman. The Jews used to say, well, this is Solomon is that king. And well, it says Lemuel in the proverb, which his mom taught him. But yes, but Lemuel is literally for the one who is El, the one who is God. That's the picture here. And then his mother taught him that. And there was no Jewish king named Lemuel. But she says, my son. And she goes down through there using an Aramaic term, Bar, rather than Ben, which is Hebrew. So she's some kind of a non-Jewish woman. Well, that takes us back to Solomon's mother. Okay, she was married to Uriah. Now, why is Uriah called the Hittite in the Bible? So you don't make the mistake because he has a Jewish name. Right? Ur is light, Yah. He's the light of Yahweh for the Hittites. His wife is also Hittite, and she is Bathsheba, daughter of the covenant. So she takes a Jewish name. And now when she starts calling him Bar, Aramaic, her own tongue, well, that makes perfect sense. It would be like marrying somebody from Mexico, and up here she's calling her child Nino. It would be just the same. All right. Now, at the end of Solomon's life, he begins to write Ecclesiastes and talks about the waste of life. If you are not focused on God and obedience to him, he says you're wasting your life. And secondly, you don't understand anything. You have not viewed life from beyond the sun. You only use your eyeballs. No faith at all. No understanding about God. And everything you're going to get is going to fail you. No matter how much money, how much pleasure, how many projects, buildings you build, you're never going to be content with these things. They will always fail you. And he ends Ecclesiastes by saying, listen, the all of man, the everything that you're concerned about is keeping the commandments of God. Now, while the story is running, 1 and 2 Chronicles are still running. Now, as he dies, Jeroboam and Rehoboam come up and the kingdom splits. And now you have the name Israel used of the north and Judah used in the south. OK, Okay? And all of a sudden, the prophets become a focal point. Interesting, not a lot of prophets up till after the time when the kingdom split. Now, you have writing prophets, speaking prophets, acting prophets. Elijah and Elisha spoke, but they did not actually write anything. You have prophets acting out scenes. By the way, here's a little insight. Did you know that the prophet's name will always match his message? If the text actually names him, and you can bet he is going to be in, oftentimes in his prophecy, his very name will be in there. But now the kings are reigning. There was never a good kingdom in the north, never a good king. Hit and miss in the south, because remember, David's throne is the throne of God, and that stayed in the south. You had the tribes from up north, and it says many of them migrated down south. Okay, now there's no such thing as the lost tribes of Israel. That's ridiculous. The tribes are actually mentioned in the New Testament, so they can't be lost if they're still there. Paul names his tribe. You've got Anna and her tribe. You've got all these guys that are being named. James is to the 12 tribes scattered abroad, and so they know who they are. Okay, and so the prophets begin to come. You got Obadiah and Joel and Jonah and Hosea. You only got a couple of prophets up north, by the way. The rest usually go down south, and then you have a couple that go to the nations, like Nahum and Jonah that went deal with Nineveh. These books all tell you about Jesus Christ, and that's what they're going to do. Jonah, right? A greater than Jonah was here, as Jonah was 3 days and three nights, etc. Jesus applies that to himself. Joel, Yahweh is God. Yahweh is El. But the prophecies in Joel are recorded in the New Testament and directly applied to the relationship of Jesus Christ. Obadiah can be the servant of Yahweh or Yahweh who is worshipped. Both would work. Hosea up in the north. Hosea is another form or spelling of the name of Jesus. Amos and Isaiah and Micah and Nahum and Zephaniah and Jeremiah, Lamentations and Habakkuk. The prophets come. They all begin to talk about our hope that we have in the future, because one of them is one is coming. All through Isaiah, I got to tell you, Isaiah, I think, says more about Christ than any other prophet. But beginning about chapter 4 or 5 of Isaiah, he just begins to name Christ in almost every single one, including the man who will come, who will sprinkle the people with his blood and become a sin offering. That's Isaiah 52, at the end through chapter 53. You can't miss that. But you've got, behold, Emmanuel is going to come. You hear people sing Emmanuel, but that's in chapter 7. But Emmanuel's mentioned again twice in chapter 8. It calls Emmanuel's land. And then he says, and God is with us. But in Hebrew, it's God is with us. It's just the word Emmanuel. Now, why the change? Well, it's always a translator's choice whether you want to just leave something as it is or try and straighten it out. But difficult ideas. Now, you know how this goes. Everything gets bad. The Assyrians deport the northern kingdom, and then pretty soon the south, they're warned that the same thing can happen to you, and they're headed for the same place, only they're going to go to Babylon. Babel means confusion. Balal is the root of that. And anyway, as the exile comes, Ezekiel and Daniel, Ezekiel goes out among the common people. Meanwhile, Daniel is in the palace. Habakkuk is up on the hilltop, and Jeremiah is actually sitting among the ruins in Jerusalem. Now, this is fascinating to me because you've got a lot of prophets around, walking the Israelites right through everything that is going on. Habakkuk is the just shall live by faith, cited three times in the New Testament, and that faith is in the Messiah, of course. Ezekiel, the Son of Man, is a term used of him. Jesus is a term for the Messiah. Daniel's called the Son of Man, also term for the Messiah. Jeremiah, chapter 1, this reason Yahweh has raised you up, because Jeremiah means to be raised up. And Lamentations, you should see that in Hebrew, 1st and 2nd and 3rd and 4th chapters. They just follow these acrostics, these alphabets, A, B, C, D, E, F, G, verse by verse and line by line. It's like poetic justice. In Lamentations, he says, the Messiah is our very breath. And again, everybody looks for, remember the woman at the well? We know Messiah is coming. Well, everybody knows that for sure. Ezekiel gives them hope, talks about their restoration one day, but he says not yet. Daniel gives them the understanding of the nations, and it's the time of the Gentiles and the Gentile rule. And so a good five chapters in Daniel are written in Aramaic, the language of the Gentiles. Jesus said Israel is going to be in out of the picture until the times of the Gentiles be fulfilled, and then God will restore them. Remember Acts 1, are you at this time restoring the kingdom to Israel? And Jesus said, it's not for you to know the times or the season which God's put in his own power for that restoration, that they will be back. The early church was well aware of that also as time went on. Now also he brings them back. Zechariah and Haggai come back to the scene as they're building the temple first, and then they're building the city. Esther comes in about this time, and the Jews are saved from utter destruction, absolute utter destruction. Nehemiah comes in after that, and Malachi closes out the Old Testament. Now, all of these are pictures of our Lord Jesus Christ all the way through. And again, that's the Old Testament in summary. You can't do a whole lot when you have just a half-hour program like this to cover all your bases. But that's just the summary of everything and how it fits. If you get that, you'll have a little bit of a grasp. Now, you could go right back, march all the way back through all of this and restart with doctrines. The sacrificial lambs, the throne. When God clothed Adam and Eve, Peter said that he clothed them with a lamb, and that lamb was Jesus. You've got a throne all the way through there. It's going to be a throne. There's a hand on the throne of God, Amalek, the Torah says, but he will not win. There's a throne of Jesus that it's all the way through there. You've got the angel of Yahweh, who in the Old Testament obviously is Jesus Christ. You've got picture after picture after type after type after type. And so Jesus said, the scriptures are about me. Open the scriptures, Acts 17. Paul used to open the scriptures and insert Jesus. Well, that's how you read it. Jesus is all the sacrifices of Leviticus. He is the garments that we wear. He is our righteousness. He is absolutely everything. We have nothing outside of him. Now, I am Dennis Dickinson for Charnock Institute of the Bible and Whitestone Christian Fellowship in Payette, where I pastor. You can contact us online at charnockedu.com or Box 221, Payette, Idaho, 83661. Call us at 642-4632 or 642-4630 to get the church. Now, Charnock Institute of the Bible is an institute like no other, and right here in the state of Idaho. Translate the entire Bible for yourself. Read all known documents up to AD 325. You'll know for yourself what the early church believed and didn't believe. You'll know what views now then are also new and which ones are not new, which ones are old, which ones they've never heard of. Come learn these things for yourself. Hope you have a great day. It's been my pleasure to be with you. God bless you.